You're listening to Beggar's Banquet, a podcast that explores the intersection of food and music. We interview bands and artists to discuss their relationship with food, both on and off the road. My name is Lucas Samuels. Growing up as an only child in New York City is not your average upbringing, and Karina Reichman is not your average 20-something-year-old. This might explain why Karina is already a multi-hyphenate. She's a professional bass player who holds down the low end in Marco Benevento's band, a band leader with her own self-titled project, a podcast host, and a businesswoman who runs a long-standing concert series called Rocks Off. In addition to her main gig touring the world with Benevento, Karina has opened for Krungbin, shared the stage with Nels Klein of Wilco, and jammed live on stage with Phish at Madison Square Garden. Yes, you heard that right, Phish at MSG. Today on Beggar's Banquet, we're going to go deep with Karina on what it's like growing up in one of the greatest food cities in the world, what happens to your eating habits on tour, and what bands actually eat at music festivals. We'll also learn about Karina's pre- and post-show meal rituals and how she developed a deep love for espresso shots and seafood towers. Welcome to Beggar's Banquet. Let's dig in. Okay, well, we've got Karina Reichman dialing in from Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Karina, thanks for coming on to the pod.
Lucas, my sincere pleasure. Thanks for reaching out, pal. Thank you.
Of course, of course. So we're going to get into food and music, two subjects which I know are favorites of yours and favorites of mine. So let's just get right into it. You're a native New Yorker, except one of the very few. Tell me about some of your earliest food memories growing up in the big city.
Oh man. Yeah, no, we are few and far between, that's for sure. Well, you know, my parents love food and love to eat and love to cook. So every night growing up, essentially, my dad would shop for food and my mom would cook it. And, you know, she has a big, you know, repertoire, great arsenal of stuff that she can make. And, you know, I feel like she was varying it up throughout my childhood, and we were just always eating fresh, local, farmers market, organic, good ingredients. And, you know, she could do everything from osso buco to crab cakes, you know, and we were just, we were doing that. And like, you know, the idea of ordering in, which of course in New York City, everybody orders in. Like when I was a young kid, I would always be like, oh, you know, why don't we order in? And they'd be like, ah, it's so shitty by the time it gets here, like, come on, like, you know, let's not,
you know? That's pre-Postmates days where everything could just come to you in 5 minutes, hot and fresh, I guess.
Well, not even, like, you know, it's just, I think they just have like a bit of a mental bias against it when they're so like into the ritual of cooking and into the ritual of shopping for the food and like, you know, thinking about the next meal and planning it out and being like, you know, I feel like it's something that they really cherish and treasure, and you know, bless them for it, because I definitely ate well as a kid. I definitely, I'm an only child, right? And you know, there's lots of things that people think of us only children as and for. But one thing that's certainly true in my case is that, like, you know, we peer with adults, if you know what I mean. Like, I was never, totally, ever fed like anything off any kid's menu. I was never like, you know, my parents didn't have any like, you know, conceptions that like I wouldn't like everything, you know, like it wasn't like, oh, we have to, you know, wait to introduce her to this type of food or this, or she's not going to like this or whatever. It was just like, no, like we cook it, you eat it. Like that's what we do here. And I think that definitely, like, I had an extremely advanced, if you will, palate, like, you know, for a 5-year-old. Where I was just eating raw oysters and like
that was gonna be my question. When did you have your first oyster? Because yeah, as an only child, I've definitely heard that before. That you eat what the adults eat. There's no special meals, and I think, you know, it's interesting. I think that most people expect, and I think there's a stereotype around New Yorkers that you pick up food or you order in or you're eating at restaurants, and everyone's kind of got small, or the perception is that people have small kitchens and they don't do a lot of cooking. But it's cool to hear that in your family that wasn't the case, and maybe it sounds like it was quite the opposite. So yeah, when did you have your first oyster and what was that like?
Certainly. Well, you know, it wasn't even thought of as like this grandiose like occasion where like, I don't know, I was in a restaurant not too long ago where I saw this family like making a whole hoopla over this young kid trying an oyster, the kid hating it, but they were like, good job, at least you tried, like whatever. It just wasn't like that. So my first oyster, like the time that I remember like eating oysters and like loving them from the jump, I was 5 years old, literally. And we used to spend our summers kind of in Paris and the south of France and whatnot. My mom's from Belgium, moved to Toronto when she was 14, then moved to Manhattan when she was like, I don't, like 27, and hasn't left. But she's French. And my dad was born in Princeton, but he has, you know, a European background. His aunt Irene, or Tante Irene, if you will, lived in the south of France. He grew up going there. He's a philosopher that, like, you know, focuses on French philosophy and whatnot. So, you know, throughout college and grad school and all that stuff, he was just like going to Paris, going to the south of France, and like, you know, meeting up with Foucault and Deleuze and Lacan, all these French thinkers, and yada, yada. But I digress. So we would go there every summer. And that's where I remember having these kind of grand plateau, if you will, like these grand platters and fruits de mer and all this stuff, where it would just be so fresh from the ocean.
That's the way to wherever. Do it. That's the way to be intro to it.
That was it. And I was just like, oh, wow. And there was something about the atmosphere, the presentation, just like the whole thing. And yet again, like, you know, there's not another kid in sight for me to hang out with. I'm hanging out with a bunch of French intellectuals and my parents, you know? So it was like, there wasn't a kid's table. There wasn't a chicken nugget. You know what I mean? It wasn't like that.
You were essentially, it's conditioning, right? Like it's, if you make it up to be, if you make the food up to be a scary thing, then kids are going to think it's scary to a certain extent. But if it's in this beautiful setting and you're in Paris and you're eating with the adults, it's like a cool thing to do. Then it's not overly surprising to me that you enjoyed it. And we'll get into your love of seafood towers, I think, a little bit later. But okay, so I wasn't expecting you to say your parents cook so much. That's super cool. Let's flip the switch on it a bit. Special occasions, were you guys dining out?
Totally. Totally. And like, you know, once in a blue moon, we would dine out, certainly. And like, you know, I remember like my first restaurant memory is going to a place called Omen, which is down in Soho, still there. Amazing, 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 beautiful restaurant on Thompson Street. And you know, now it's become kind of like we've seen Yoko Ono there, we've seen Patti Smith there, like it's like definitely a spot. Cool spot, but not one that is overly talked about, I would say. It's rather small, it's not like particularly chic in setting wise or anything like that, but it does have like just an ambiance that you enjoy, you know. And I remember being taken there and like, you know, I was raised on the Upper West Side, and to go from the Upper West Side to take the pilgrimage down to Soho for dinner as like a little kid. And it's a Japanese restaurant. Fantastic, fantastic. Great, great food. And I still love going there. And that was kind of like my like family restaurant growing up, or like what I like to think of it as, you know. So when I go there with other people, I'm like, I grew up going here. This is my shit. Like,
that's my parents. Awesome.
Yeah. So that was... that's one. There was a place on the Upper West Side that has since closed called Docks, which is a seafood restaurant, which there are a few other locations in the city that still exist, I want to say. But admittedly, I have not, you know, checked out any of the other ones. But the one that was near my house growing up was certainly like, we would go there, get lobster and oysters and French fries. And that was a special occasion meal for sure.
Nice. That sounds epic. And it was. And, you know, as a school kid, are your parents packing you lunches? It sounds like maybe you're not getting like the traditional like ham and cheese sandwich that maybe some of the other kids are getting. What kind of stuff are you bringing to school growing up?
Well, funny you ask, Lucas, because, well, up until first grade, you did have to pack a lunch, and it was ham and cheese sandwiches and nothing too special. I was obsessed with bacon for a short amount of time in preschool. And I do remember my mother just sending me strips of bacon.
Bacon makes everything better.
That was good. That was definitely good. And yeah, nothing, you know, too earth shattering in terms of like from like, you know, preschool through first grade. But I will admit that the school I went to from second through 12th grade, we always had like a camera crew in our cafeteria because we had this guy, Chef Bobo, who was from the French Culinary Institute, was Derek Jeter's private chef. It was some of the most artisanal, insane, crazy food. And like, you know, there were always these camera crews. And I was always like the kid who was like trying to get in front of the camera to be like, it's so fantastic that we have Chef Bobo here.
What was Chef Bobo cooking up? Literally, do you remember any dishes?
Everything under the sun, like, you know, what you would get in a restaurant, you know. But then occasionally there would be like, you know, there's Burger Day, and that was like, oh, cool. But, you know, he made every fish under the sun, like, you know, every, like, you know, there would be just like a nice protein, nice vegetables, you know, a salad bar and a sandwich bar, but like a really nice one. And that was the first time I had sriracha, like many, many, many moons ago, you know, where I was like, this is good.
Yeah, that's cool.
So we had a really, really amazing school lunch program, and they still continue to at the school I went to, which is called Calhoun, if anyone's wondering.
Shout out to Calhoun.
Shout out to Calhoun. They really, I mean, honestly, I make it sound like, you know, a spoiled little bougie situation, but honestly, it was just like good nutrition. And like, the whole concept of that was like, you know, kids around the country are fed shit in their cafeteria lunchrooms for the most part. And like, how great is that for learning and productivity? Like, not great if you ask me. So
yeah, totally.
I mean, there. Yeah.
We were eating grilled cheese sandwiches, and probably the most nutritious thing on the menu at my lunchroom was like chocolate milk. So
Exactly.
I wish I had a Chef Bobo.
Chef Bobo was killer, but I will digress just slightly. As soon as we were allowed to go out for lunch, and this is where it's like so stupid, but you know, we're a block from Zabar's, like one of the best, you know, Jewish delicatessen grocery stores ever, you know, with like world famous smoked salmon. And like, I don't know, there's tons of food right around my school, right? So as soon as we were allowed to go out for lunch, which I believe started in eighth grade and then through 12th grade, like you could just choose your own adventure. If you wanted to go out and grab your own lunch, you totally could. I did that so much more than I should have. And I was like eating dollar pizza and Dr. Pepper and like being like, oh, this is great. And, you know, eating Subway sandwiches with my friends and like, just like, you know, thinking back now of like, you know, how much money I could have saved and like, you know, how much more nutrition I could have got if I just kept eating the Chef Bobo school lunch. I regret that, Lucas. I regret that. But it was fun times, you know.
It takes a big person to admit that. But I'm sure, and I can't imagine, a lunchtime Reuben sandwich is the most nutritious thing to be going into an afternoon with. But hard to resist the Jewish deli.
What are you going to do? You know, it was also just fun to get out and like, you know, you go mess around with your friends and
totally.
Go down Broadway, do weird shit, go to Barnes and Nobles, like, I don't know, get weird. It was fun. It was good times. I regret nothing. Never mind. I take it back.
You can get into all sorts of trouble at Barnes and Noble.
Dude, we totally did. I can't even, some of those stories are best left untold, but yeah, totally.
Yeah, sneaking into the adult literature section at the tender age of 13, I'm sure.
Oh, man. Totally.
So, Karina, was there much music in your household growing up?
You know, yes and no. And I say that respectfully and with love, but certainly no Beatles, no Rolling Stones, no Bob Dylan, none of the normal shit that you would expect somebody like me who became completely entrenched in, you know, the roots of rock and roll and, you know, tracing everything musically that had happened from 1950 to the present. And like, that became my entire reason for living, you know, that certainly didn't come from my parents. My parents listened to classical, like my dad, when he was writing, would either listen to like Glenn Gould classical music or Brazilian music for the most part. And like, which was very cool. And I love Caetano Veloso as much as the next guy, totally into it. But there was no like, there were a few CDs, you know, and there was a CD player, but there was no vinyl. There was no like real, like my mom had zero you know, music collection of her own per se. So it was definitely, I mean, you know, in terms of like some of my friends growing up where like their parents were spoon feeding them classic rock and showing them all this stuff and the Talking Heads and I don't even know, like all this cool music that I became completely obsessed with, and the Grateful Dead, you know, American heroes to so many of like, you know, my friends' parents who then, you know, got introduced to that music in that way. I certainly did not have that. But having said that, my parents were very excited when I became completely entrenched in music. And then it would be like, you know, it was kind of reverse. I would play them a Beatles song and they'd be like, oh yeah, love this one. I was like, you guys couldn't have shown me this? Like, no? I feel like every kid gets spoon-fed Beatles songs now.
That's kind of cool, though. That's an interesting path to that kind of music and that genre of music. Because, you know, I think it's often the case that you hear your parents' music growing up so much, and you don't, maybe you don't necessarily like it, right? Like, you kind of rebel against what your parents are playing, or you think it's lame growing up. So to discover it on your own later and then kind of share that with your parents is pretty interesting. But why Brazilian music for your dad? What's the connection there?
It's a great question. No idea. Couldn't tell you. We went there once in the second grade. My dad gave a lecture there and we went to the Copacabana Palace. That was sick. But otherwise, I don't know. I think he just really vibed on it. I'm not sure.
I love that. Probably takes him back to that vacation.
Totally. Oh, man. And me, you and, you know, him and me both. That was good stuff for sure. But the one thing I'll say about that is that, you know, I think you're totally right. And a lot of kids do get spoon-fed music through their parents and end up kind of rebelling against it. And for me, at the very least, like, I was just so self-motivated to find out everything I could about music that, like, it was very much my thing, you know? It wasn't like, oh, you know, my folks will be so whatever if I dig into this. Like, you know, it was just like, no, music is my thing. And, like, I will find out as much as I humanly can about this. And I do think, like, same goes for lessons and stuff. I never took a music lesson, not once. Like, I've never taken a, like, nothing, you know? It was all just my pure, like, will of wanting to be surrounded by music and musicians and people who were better than me, and like learning things from my friends and learning things online and just playing along to records and yeah, playing with people who were better than me, and just like that kind of sink or swim vibe, as opposed to doing anything the normal way, which again, my parents were super supportive of. It was very, very cool. Like, you know, cause I think a lot of kids get forced into piano lessons or guitar lessons, end up hating it, end up giving it up because it feels more like a chore than true love, you know? And for sure.
I think that's like a very typical story, is you get forced piano lessons and then you never want to touch the piano again. And then maybe you pick up an instrument later on down the road. But I think so many people don't realize that it's like learning the piano is actually the coolest thing. Everyone and their brothers and sisters knows how to play guitar, but it's the person, you know, at a party who can sit down at the piano that really wows everyone.
It's true. And it's a great instrument to start out on, because it's laid out so intelligently and methodically that, like, if you learn all the notes and where they are in succession, like, you can understand things so much better than you can if you just pick up a guitar and, totally, like, try to read it in that way, which, you know, yeah.
So how does bass come into the equation for you? And how did you, and then, you know, when do you decide that you want to pursue music professionally?
Well, I started playing guitar when I was like 12, 13. And I just got my neighbor's flea market $12 terrible acoustic guitar and just got completely obsessed with it, and then played that for a good while, and then begged for an electric guitar for my birthday, my 13th birthday, and my Uncle Mark bought me one. Thanks, Uncle Mark. And that was the beginning of the end of the rest of my life. Little did I know, you know, and that was the funny story about that, is we were all at Guitar Center getting this Ibanez guitar, right? And they tried to sell us a gig bag to go with it. And my mom was like, gig bag? What? She's going to take this out of the house, you know? And then next thing you know, like, I was like, come on, Ma, I need a gig bag. Like, what if I take it somewhere? Like, whatever. So we got the gig bag. Next week, I'm in my first band, which is a punk band called False Arrest, my eighth grade punk band. And you know, we gig around the city and we're just like, you know, a bunch of hell-raising 13-year-olds. It's great. And, you know, that was eighth grade. Then my entire high school was just completely tunnel vision, music, like, you know, played guitar in many a band and with many people, just like jamming. I went to this cool, it's like a rock school, but it wasn't School of Rock. It was like an offshoot. You know, met so many dear friends and collaborators and whatnot. And around that time is when I started just playing guitar and bass simultaneously. I just picked it up and it was like, oh, they're the same notes, they're just fewer strings. It's great, love it, you know. But it was not until, flash forward to I'm 22 years old, about to graduate from NYU, have a full-time job as the general manager for a concert promoter in the city. And I get the call from Marco Benevento saying, will you fill in for Dave Drywitz, who's in Ween, my favorite band, and Joe Russo's Almost Dead, et cetera, because he, you know, Ween is coming back. He can't keep up doing both things, blah, blah, blah. And that was the moment where I was like, holy shit, like, yes, I'm a huge fan, and it would be an honor to learn your music and play your music. And that's when I was like, oh shit, I think I'm a bass player now, or I should be.
So I definitely want to come back to this because it sounds like a super pivotal moment in your life. But your parents are both educators, if I understand correctly. How do they take to you wanting to pursue music professionally as a career choice?
Well, it wasn't until I got that gig that I even, like, I didn't think, at that time, like, you know, throughout, like, my 18, 19, 20, 21, like, you know, I'm playing in five bands going nowhere. I'm playing my ass off, but, like, it's not, there doesn't appear to be a clear path ahead of me where I could be a professional musician, you know, and it didn't even really necessarily occur to me. And I was, you know, as I said, I was the GM of a concert promoter called Rocks Off. And that was, you know, kind of my life at the time. And I was, you know, I had a salary all throughout college. And I was like, oh, you know, this, if not this, will lead to something else. And I'll just be a chick who works in the music business. And that's kind of what I thought was going to happen in my life. But then Marco Benevento changed everything, you know, and it was, you know, for those who don't know, he was somebody I'd been listening to for the, you know, all of my teen years, highly respected, you know. Dave, his ex-bass player, was a good friend of mine and a mentor, an idol, a guru, like, call it what you will. And so just from getting that Marco gig and that being such a big deal to me at the time and still, you know, and my parents knowing a little bit about what that meant to me and what that meant in the grand scheme of things, they were like completely thrilled and floored that such a thing had appeared and manifested itself in my life. So if that answers your question, you know, it's just, it was less of like, I'm gonna do music and I'm gonna be a musician and everybody's gonna love it and I will stop at nothing. I'm unfortunately a little more realistic than that, you know. I wish I was less, because then maybe I would have hustled more into that direction or done something. But I was just like, look, like, I'm a hustler, but my hustle was taking me towards music business. That's just what it appeared to be at the time. And then the tides shifted, thank God, because now I feel like, I don't know, I will never stop to make sure that I can create for a living. You know what I mean? I will absolutely, like, you know, there is nothing that can prevent my, like, joy that I get through doing what I do. And now I've been shown this kind of path that I just need to keep carving out. So,
yeah, well, it sounds like you were cutting your teeth. I mean, playing in five different bands, you know, taking on the bass, playing guitar. I mean, they say luck is opportunity meets preparedness. So it sounds like that you had kind of queued yourself up for that. Tell me about your first time meeting Marco and what that's like, and then tell me about the first time your parents met Marco.
Oh, good call. Yeah, no, I mean, certainly, like, I definitely, I theoretically made that opportunity happen just by virtue of knowing the right people and having my shit together and being hopefully a fun person to have in the band and on tour and whatnot. I had met Marco a few times before I got the call to fill in his band, but we had hung out late night, Brooklyn Bowl, like, you know, stuff like that. And like, I certainly knew him, but obviously not as well as I was about to. And so my first rehearsal with Marco before my first three shows, whenever that was April 2016, right? And we had one day and night of rehearsals a month before that. And I was nervous as all hell going into it. And before that, I was, you know, in my like house in Manhattan, just like going over the tunes nervously before like getting on the Amtrak to go up to Woodstock to his place. And like, you know, I felt that this was a huge deal and I needed to rise to the occasion. Like, that's just like, you know, bottom line. I was like, you need to nail this. You need to really crush it. And there were like 40 tunes I had to learn in like 2 months. 2.5 months, something like that. So there's a lot of music, and a lot of music that wasn't completely straightforward, if you know what I'm saying. So I studied my ass off, got up there, and like, I guess I crushed it, because he was just completely like, that was it, killed it, like, yeah, on every tune, like hardly any notes on anything. And then we did not rehearse again or see each other until, you know, sound check at the very first gig, you know? So I was just like, oh my God, wait, are you serious? Like, we're not gonna get together again? And he was like, no, why? You got it, like, you're good. And I was like, wow, that's really crazy. Anyway, he is the most effervescent, fun-loving, hilarious, just, you know, the best energy, funny guy to be around.
He seems like the kind of person who would make a good impression on parents.
Oh, certainly. And then, yeah, and my parents must have met him at the Music Hall of Williamsburg, which was my third show in that first little pocket where I was filling in for Dave, who was out with Ween, right? And, I mean, the backstage party we had after that show. And by the way, I thought that was going to be, like, I thought I was signing on for three gigs, like, or just filling in here and there. Little did I know, now I've played hundreds with him and whatnot. But my parents came backstage, our travel record player and this tiny room filled with like 25 people, and we're throwing limes and ice and, you know, screaming, and people are picking me up and celebrating, being like, hip hip hooray. It was crazy. And my parents from the get-go were like, this is a good person, this is a great guy. And not only is this a great guy, but like, his energy and my energy are very similar in funny ways. And like, we just riff on shit and like hype each other up, make each other laugh. He's the guy who like first thing in the morning when everybody's exhausted, like crawling back into the van from the hotel room, like he's like, what's up, motherfuckers? Let's have some breakfast mimosas. And he's just, you know, making everybody smile from the get-go. He wants everybody to feel excellent all the time.
And that's great. It sounds, yeah, like what you want in a band leader. Okay, so you play those three shows, and then the Marco Benevento trio decides, I mean, you know, you end up going on tour. Marco is what, 40 something, and who's, yep, playing drums at that time?
At that Borger? Time is Andy Borger. Yep, totally.
And how old's Andy?
Older. Andy's about 50 now.
Okay, so you're about to hit the road with two guys who are probably about twice your age. What's that like? What's going through your head?
Well, funnily enough, you know, I think this maybe is more only child syndrome coming through, but I'll tell you, Lucas, it didn't even really occur to me as like an age thing at all. Like, I literally, most of my friends have been older my whole life, like, and still are, certainly. And like, you know, who's to say if this is like more of that peers with adults thing. Also, I will say my parents are very old considering how old I am. Like, my mom was 43 when she had me. My dad was like 46 or 47. So like, you know, they're now 70 and 74. So that makes 40-year-olds seem like nothing to me, even though I'm 27, or at the time I was 22. Like, and maybe that's some weird mental fuck up, but I'm just being honest. Like, it really, like, 40 is like a child to me. 40 is like very much my peer, you know what I mean? And that's, yeah. And even more so than that, Marco is so like a 12-year-old boy in lots of ways, you know what I mean? Like in the sweetest, most exuberant way, you know? And Andy too, like we're all just like a bunch of goofballs who like, you know, sure, they're like, you know, about twice my age. And I don't know, I really never thought twice about it in that respect. And I was made to feel so welcome, so at home, so nothing weird, like just fun, fun, more fun, laughing, sleeping, laughing, eating, playing. Like that's what going on tour with those guys is like. Like we just have the best time.
I love to hear that. So tell me what it's like eating on the road. I think for folks who have never experienced a tour before, I think we picture gas station snacks, lots of bad coffee, pulling over every couple hours to use the bathroom. But I know you're someone who takes food seriously and tell me what you guys are eating when you're kind of traveling around the country.
Well, very lucky for me, Lucas, very, very lucky for me. Not only is Marco as shellfish obsessed as I am, but so was Andy, so is Dave Butler, who plays drums with us now, so is Jeff Volkhausen and Julian Booker, our sound and lighting crew. We're all bivalve fanatics, which is great news. And not only that, but just like everybody really values good food and eating well. And also, you know, it's so not like any of the stories that you've heard of bands on the road. Like, you know, I've heard stories where people like will go to like a gas station, take a hot dog bun and fill it with nacho cheese and it's free and that's dinner. Like that's some sick shit. So yeah, it's not like that. So what it is like is, depending on where we are, Marco generally will do the Yelp sifting and find generally the nicest restaurant in town. Like honestly, like I really, when I tell people this, they're like, wait, what? And I'm like, seriously, like we take it really, really seriously everywhere we go. And we have some go-tos, like when we're in Portland, Maine, we go to Eventide, which is one of the greatest restaurants of all time, because we're going to have brown butter lobster rolls, the best oysters anybody's ever had, and like, you know, a million different crudos and whatnot, and it's just going to be fantastic. And then, like, I don't know if we're in, well, it's a bad example, but I was just thinking about, what's that place? Shit. It's like above Seattle.
We can come back to it. Well,
either way, whatever it is, you know, so, like sushi, generally speaking, like even in landlocked places, like, you know, that would be like worst resort where Marco's like, oh, I found this sushi place, like looks good. And we'll have like some rolls, some miso soups, like whatever. And then do that before the gig. And I don't know. I don't know how I found myself in this group that values this as much as I do, but just about everywhere we go, we're eating a spectacular meal before we play. And if not, like, that's because we ran out of time, got there late, everything's rushed. And then, like, you know, we go around the corner and find a decent restaurant to eat.
Got it. It's so interesting to hear, because I think when you take food seriously and when you're traveling with a group of people who aren't necessarily as like-minded, yeah, at least to me, there's nothing worse than having to, you know, go to a restaurant that you don't really want to, or not eat as well as you want to, because every restaurant you can go to is an experience, right? And every meal could be the best meal of your life or a very memorable meal. So when you have to kind of like make that concession, it can hurt sometimes.
Oh, big time. And like, I really feel like Marco, of all people, really, like, you know, like we forget because you get so trapped in it. And like, of course, you know, now we've had about a year off, which is its own problem, but like you can get stuck in this kind of hamster wheel where you don't realize how special what you're doing is, you know, and like how lucky you are to travel the country and to Japan and to the UK with like your best friends and just play music. And it's unbelievable. And of course, like, you know, Marco is not that way. Marco knows, he's like, guys, like, we're here, this is the best restaurant ever. And like, you know, we have a total bacchanal of insane, you know, experiences and times in restaurants together that like, I'll never get those times back. They were so singular and special. And like, you
know, it sounds like those might be almost as memorable as some of the shows themselves.
Oh, certainly. And I have, you know, I could tell you a few like specific like restaurants across the country that like we just keep going back to that are like, you know, it's part of going to Charleston, it's part of going to Austin, it's part of going to Atlanta, is to go to this place, that place, that, you know, whatever it is. And that just becomes an amazing thing too, you know. And then of course the restaurants are like, oh boy, here's this circus again. Hey,
yeah, you guys are a bit of a motley crew, I'm sure, when you roll in.
Loud, obnoxious, loud, hilarious to me. And you know, I'm sure it's a lot for some restaurants to handle, but yeah, no, it's definitely something that is taken extremely seriously in the Marco camp that I like to really try and replicate as much as possible when I'm on tour with my band. And I really, you know, want my bandmates to feel the same thing, where it's like, we're doing something special together. Of course, we can't eat at five-star restaurants every night, but we're not going to do the fucking nacho cheese and the hot dog bun either. You know what I mean? And there's like, we're going to make it special and we're going to eat well. And also, for the record, like, you're living in kind of crazy circumstances when you're on the road, and you're sleeping at weird times and in weird ways, and you're coming up and off of your adrenaline kicks, and it's, you get more and more like a circus freak as the tour goes on. You get into like this weird fringy, like, we're like a gang of lunatics and we're coming to your town, and you know, it can get exhausting, and you have to take care of yourself or else you burn out. And like, it's kind of almost like being an athlete to some small extent, where if you're not putting good food in your body, I mean, it's not easy even when you are putting good food in your body, you know. But like, I think Marco and the and company, like, you know, they've been road dogs forever. Like, he knows that if you are just like eating Taco Bell, you're not going to have a good experience. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no doubt.
You're not going to perform well. You're just, it's going to be bad for everybody. So, yeah.
So switching gears just a little bit, what's like what's a snack that you guys always stock in the van?
Great question. Well, you know, we each have our rest stop tendencies, you know, and if we do go to a rest stop, I always will get the Chex Mix Bold Party Blend, which is like with Worcestershire sauce or whatever. Like, that's the flavor. That's my go-to. Marco likes these like pretzels with peanut butter inside. Like, you ever see
yeah.
that?
Yeah, yeah. Combos.
He loves that. Totally. Way into that. You know, he is really into yerba mate. So there's always a huge thing of mate in the van, which is pretty fun. And that just will caffeinate you as soon as you get to the venue and you pour some hot water on.
Yeah, that's like the yerba is, it's almost like a different caffeinated experience than having a coffee.
Totally. And one could argue a much better one, even though I like getting cracked out and like crashing and burning and being like, yeah, I feel great. But like that, the mate can definitely just like, it's more of like an even keeled energy throughout the day and the night, which definitely has its place. In fact, I should probably start doing more of that.
No doubt. All right, well, you've played some like massive music festivals, Levitate, Telluride, Green River. Tell me what the food situation is like, or the catering situation for bands and artists. Because I think, you know, as a music festival attendee, some people will choose the festivals based on what kind of food is actually happening there. But I think we don't get to see what's going on behind the scenes. So fill me in.
Sure. I mean, it really varies festival to festival. That's definitely true. I know up by you, Oceaga, right? That's, or what is it, Oceaga?
Yeah, Oceaga in Montreal, yep.
Yeah, that's the one that everybody always talks about having the greatest setup for artists and like for VIPs and whatnot. Like, that's like some world-renowned chefs come and chef it up backstage. So I look forward to that day. Depends, man. Like, you know, usually it's not bad. It's usually pretty good. I haven't had any times where, well, that's not true. I've played some of the smaller, more swag, you know, South Jersey Wook Fests where it's cold burgers and warm beer, and like the guy who's supposed to be feeding you is like falling asleep and, you know, has a spatula in his hand, and you're like, sir, could I get my dinner? And he's like, oh, my bad. And then, you know, serves it up. So, you know, I've been on both sides of the coin where, like, you know, if you play, like, a shiesty Wookfest that's not, like, big enough to have the infrastructure of, like, some proper shit going on, it can be dicey. Having said that, normally you go, you have a meal ticket, you get there, it's very welcoming, there's, like, a nice catering squad. You know, nothing crazy. There's, like, usually salad bar, some different variations on proteins and vegetables, different grains.
And are you guys trying to eat light before the show, or do you fill up and then eat after? I've heard different things on this.
Usually you try not to, like, completely overdo it before the show. Totally. Which is why, like, you know, honestly, like, when we go for all that shellfish and Japanese food for the most part as, like, our number one pick, it's because that food is light and you're not, like, weighing yourself down necessarily with burgers and, you know, fries and chicken fingers and stuff like that, you know. So
it's like choosing fish at the wedding so you can dance the whole night and not feel like a slob.
Exactly. It's exactly like that, which is a real thing. It's a real thing. So at festivals, yeah, no, I tend to err on the side of less before, and then after, I'm an animal. I'm like, I'm eating three plates full of, you know, various things. And I'm also like that. Like, we did a few tour bus tours a couple years ago, and that's a whole other way of living where you're like, I was using late night food as a way to, like, calm down, you know, and a way to come down. So, like, wherever we were, you know, you sleep outside the venue in a mobile party machine where everybody's just, like, so having the best time, but, like, it's also your house, you know what I mean? And you also have to put yourself down and, like, not stay up all night with your friends, unless you do, but, like, you'll burn out eventually if you keep doing that. So I would just be like, you know, find the local pizza place that's, like, the only thing that's open and whatever, and come back with two pies and, like, go crazy and, like, eat way more than you're supposed to do at, you know, 2:30 in the morning, and then crash and then go to bed, you know? So that's not necessarily the most healthy relationship to food.
Well, I don't think a lot of people realize, and you can speak to this much better than I can, but the endorphin rush that you're coming off of after playing a show, I'm sure your body's just absolutely fiending food and nutrition. So it doesn't surprise me to hear that you're dummying two pizzas after a concert.
Oh, 1,000%. No, it really, that's a really real thing. At least for me, I feel like I put out so much when I'm up there, and it's like, you know, your whole day is centered around this 90-minute, 2-hour performance. Like, you have to be in tip top shape for it. You are focused on being the best version of yourself for that small amount of time, you know, and after, where you can, like, take this big exhale, yeah, you're starving. You're, like, you know, emotionally and physically kind of taxed, and you're just like, oh, wow, okay, let's go. So I always, like, you know, if I don't finish a meal and there's, like, stuff that's, like, left over, I always take it and always end up hammering it after the show. That's definitely a thing I do.
Gotcha. So you've told me kind of about some of the, well, you've told me about kind of one of the worst music festival food situations. You guys travel to Japan, you play at Festival de Fru. I might be pronouncing that wrong.
Right.
You guys love seafood, so you're in seafood mecca, essentially. Tell me what it was like going to Japan and eating there.
Oh my God. Oh, I think about it every day. I'd like to go back right now. Oh my God. Sorry, I blacked out. Yes. Oh, Lucas, it was so good. It was the best time to be alive. And, you know, the crazy part about doing that was, like, that festival was in a town called Shizuoka, I think, which is, like, an hour or two south of Tokyo. But they flew us out and put us up in Tokyo for, like, 2 nights or 3 nights before we even went down to the festival grounds, basically. So we had 2 good full days of eating in Tokyo, which was really just completely absurd. And, you know, just omakases. And I forget, what was that? Man, no, it's better than you think. It's better than, like, and I still can't get over it. I'm speechless. It really is something. And, you know, the best thing was going to the fish market because you just go walk through and you're just like, oh, and they'll just cut you a piece of Otoro.
Right from the belly of the beast.
Oh, it'll kill you. Oh, my God. That's just the best piece of fish you've ever had.
And at the festival itself, is it the same kind of situation? I imagine they're feeding you well in Japan at a music festival.
You definitely got fed very well. And that festival was so cool. And it was basically held, like, on the grounds of, like, a resort where, like, in 1982 was probably the fanciest thing of all time, but, like, hasn't been updated since then. But really had its charms and was a lovely place and everything. But on the grounds, there were a lot of, you know, they do everything better there. So, like, any food vendor, like, on the grounds was phenomenal. Even if it was just, like, you know, some kebab thing. It was, like, the best kebab thing. And the great, you know, it was really fun because all the artists stayed, like, at this resort, essentially, where in the morning there was, like, you know, a buffet at the resort and whatnot. And it's like, okay, resort, buffet, like, sounds good, whatever. It was so good. And they had
probably not getting an omelet bar at a Japanese breakfast buffet.
It was like morning curry, which I don't even know what that means, but, you know,
something that'll cure your hangover.
Oh, it really was. Oh my God, it was so good. And, like, you know, you put a little rice in, like, a soup, and it's like the most amazing broth, and you're
restorative. Yeah.
It was so delicious. It was such, and so fun, be it like a Japanese buffet every morning, like with the band and crew and everybody's significant others. Marco's kids were there. It was like so fun, so crazy. Yeah.
And I've heard that the audiences in Japan are like the best in the world for if you're a band playing live music.
It was amazing. It was amazing. I expected them somehow to be more timid than they were, but it's not even that they're timid. It's that they're listening.
They're respectful. They're quiet and they listen.
Totally. So, like, you know, you'll do something crazy bombastic and they'll rise with you and they'll be screaming their heads off. And then, like, you know, you end the song on the floor, like, da 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 da, blackout. And they're like, whoa. And then, like, they're prepared for you to do your next thing. You know, they're like, there's no screaming between songs where they're like, ah, I lost my cell phone or whatever shit that you hear here in the U.S. But no, they were amazing. They listen, they're attentive, they're respectful, and they go with you. You know, they really do. They're amazing.
That's got to be great as a performer. Tell me about the coffee or the espresso situation in Japan. Is it mostly tea, or were you finding what you... I know you're fueled by espresso, so what were you doing over there?
Thank you for your concern. Yeah, no, I was concerned too. But I'll tell you, I kind of switched over to matcha while I was there, which I'm a huge fan of.
When in Japan?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I felt like there was a different matcha bar on every corner that was phenomenal. You know, it's just, I feel like the care that they put in over there, you know, just surpasses everything that we do over here in the West. I mean, not to be that guy, but like everything big or small, you know. And the thing that blew me away was, like, you know, at the train station, like the pre-packaged food, like, I don't know what the train station in Toronto is that could, like, liken this. But, like, if you go to Penn Station here, it's getting better. But, like, let's say you just go to, like, the shittiest bodega in New York, like, and you get, like, a pre-prepared sandwich or something like that. Or, no, that's not even a good example either. Like, a gas station. You're at a gas station in rural Pennsylvania, right? And you go and you, like, get, like, some pre-prepared sandwich, and it's terrible, right? In Japan, that doesn't exist. Anything pre-prepared is phenomenal.
Well, the convenience store food there is supposed to be amazing.
Exactly. And they're like their version of, you know, 7-Eleven is called Lawson. And like an egg sandwich, which is not even like something I'm particularly fond of, like an egg salad sandwich. I would never get that.
Yeah, here. That'll freak you out at a traditional Western gas station.
Definitely. But there, and my buddy, shout out to Jai Wilson, he was like, just go to a Lawson, get an egg salad sandwich and a bag of strangely flavored chips. Like, just like whichever one looks the weirdest, like, get that one. I'm like, all right, pal. All right. And I still think about it. It's some, like the bread, the care, the packaging. I don't know, just so whatever they're doing to ensure quality over there is phenomenal.
Yeah, so, even the mass market stuff has TLC.
Exactly. But okay. To go back to your espresso point, yes, I was definitely, I think I had plenty of espresso, but kind of switched to matcha. Kind of, you know.
You got to be adaptable when you're on the road.
Felt right.
Even if you're in Japan.
Exactly.
Okay, so you come back from tour, any tour in general, and you're back in New York. What's your ideal food day? Like, where are you trying to visit for like breakfast, lunch, and dinner and late night? If you've been away for a while and you need to, you know, feel like you're back in the city.
Need to reset. These are great questions. So I would say the quintessential and like very, you know, I'm a New York Jew and I like my lox, my bagels, my cream cheese, the whole nine. I like to go to the Russ and Daughters Cafe if I can get in, which Russ and Daughters, you know, very famous appetizing store on Houston, right? Opened up about a block away, their own restaurant, which is sit down table service. They bring the stuff to you and they're best known for these boards where you get a board full of smoked fish. And you can choose like you want a bagel, bialy, like whatever it is. And they just, I don't know, the act of doing the schmear, getting it all together is my personal idea of heaven. So that's breakfast. That's what I would hit. Lunch-wise, there are two that come to mind, like as like, okay, I'm back, let's do it.
We'll give you two.
Thank you. That would be great. First one would be Cullen Pistol, which is this seafood restaurant that's like a part of Chelsea Market, which is a famous destination in Chelsea. And my pal is the chef over there. Shout out to my friend Dave Siegel, who always, you know, he's a huge music fan and a lovely human and always takes great care of me. And we talk music, we talk seafood, and
Dave comes through.
Dave really comes through, and you know, we text and chat regularly regardless. So, you know, I feel very much at home when I show up at Cullen Pistol. Even these days during the pandemic, like they're serving outside. I'll come by, Dave will bring out some crazy thing, we'll chat. It feels like home. It feels like you're well taken care of. And then the second that I really like in terms of like lunch, I love going to Cafe Lafayette, which is on Lafayette Street. It's like, you know, Balthazar is very much known in terms of its grandeur and it's like, you know, it's French brasserie vibes and whatnot.
That French onion soup.
Totally. And it's classic and it's great. I'm not talking shit on Balthazar. But to me, I would go to Lafayette like 10 times out of 10 before I go to Balthazar. And not just because it's a little more under the radar and less full of like business douchebags, you know, who are like on their lunch break or tourists for that matter. But like, going to Cafe Lafayette, ordering 2 dozen oysters and a steak tartare and some fries, frites, if you will, that's my idea of a good time. So would love to do that. This is, you know, I'm having a real splurge of a day, right? Like,
for sure. This is okay, a no great. Holds bar. You can have whatever you want.
Fantastic, because dinner is really going to cost me. I'm going. Actually, both dinner and late night are really both going to cost me. So dinner, and this is like, oh, this is the best dream day of all time. I hope one day to be wealthy enough to pull this off. Anyway,
or just post-pandemic.
Yeah, good point. You know, YOLO. I would go, you know, I feel like I touched on it, but I didn't really tell you how much the omakase format really does it for me. And for your listeners who don't know what that means, it means that, you know, there's a sushi chef who essentially prepares and serves you one piece at a time. And this can take, you know, 2 hours or
hours,
more,
yeah.
Or, you know, whatever's clever. But there's something about the pacing and the focus on the craft of each individual piece that you're tasting that really does it for me. So I would like to go to an omakase for dinner. And I think it's got to be Nakazawa, because that is just a classic one. And if it wasn't Nakazawa, it would be this place called Shuko, which is on, I think, 12th Street, which is pretty sublime. But honestly, you can't really go wrong when you're doing these things. I could rattle off, you know, five more for you. And honestly, I wouldn't be mad to end up at any one of them for dinner. I would just be glad to be part of the ritual, served one piece at a time by a grandmaster. That really sounds appealing to me. So I would do that. And then just to add insult to injury, for the late night, I would, you're going to think I'm a real sick fuck, which I am, but that's okay. Can I curse on your podcast? I already have 100 times. Anyway. Yeah,
totally.
I would go for the Karina quintessential Sullivan Street bang bang, which means you go to Blue Ribbon Sushi, which serves until 2 a.m. You close the place out, and then you walk about 50 feet south to the original Blue Ribbon Brasserie, which serves until 4 a.m.
Wow. And
I'm embarrassed to say how many times I've done both of those things in succession without going to an omakase before or, you know, any of the above. And then, yeah, man, I think you just sleep until 2 p.m. the next day and hope you don't die of mercury poisoning, right? Like that.
Yeah, it's a lot of fish for one day. Good thing this is just a dream day, but those all sound like delicious, amazing options. All right, Karina.
You're making me want to do it, though. You're making me want to. I'm going to report back if I can ever pull something like that off. That would be very impressive. So
yeah, we'll send you the Beggar's Banquet corporate card, and you can just charge it back to us.
That would be huge, because you did put the idea in my head. So yeah, thanks, pal.
Yeah, don't hold me to that one. But we're going to move you into the rapid fire questions. I just need your off the cuff responses on this one. Let's get right into it. Best pizza slice in the city?
Joe's.
Best espresso shot in New York?
Oof. Oh, my God. Cafe Reggio?
Best seafood tower?
Colin Pistol.
Most overrated restaurant in the city?
Oh, man. Tao.
New York bagels or Montreal bagels?
New York. Y'all Montreal bagels are whack. I hate to tell you, brother. I know you're from up north. Oh, no, they're no good, dude. They're not fluffy. They're too thin. They're like thin dick bagels. We can't have that. Nope. Next.
Shake Shack or In-N-Out?
Oof. In-N-Out, I begrugglingly say.
Yep. Bacon, egg, and cheese, or smoked salmon and cream cheese?
Smoked salmon and cream cheese, but that's tough too. Very tough.
Favorite bass player of all time?
Oh, sick. Fuck. Bootsy Collins.
Favorite venue to play as an artist?
Oh, man. The Independent in San Francisco.
Favorite place to see a concert as a fan?
The Beacon Theater.
Your most memorable concert to date?
Oh, holy shit. That I've played or attended?
That you've attended.
Okay. Fish 12/30/18. Madison
Square. Okay, a pre-New Year's show. Yeah. New Year's run, but not the New Year's Eve.
Correct.
Most memorable gig that you've played?
Oof. Honestly, maybe that Japan Festival, Fruit Fest. That was something.
Cool. Last two questions for you. What's your death row meal? And then what's your desert island album?
Oh, man. I love these. I love them. Oh. Well, I mean, I think it's got to be an omakase, but maybe one like, you know, in Japan that takes about 8 hours to just delay the inevitable, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Stretch it out.
Just got to stretch it out. And man, desert island album. Just one is so tough. That's just, it's hell. It's hell. Oh, you know what? You're going to laugh at me and I'm going to laugh at myself. But the one that comes to mind right now. Odelay, Beck, do it.
I love that. That's a great choice.
Thank you. It feels eclectic enough to keep me...
keep you interested.
Occupied. Yeah, you know, it has enough of all the things I like, and it's just weird enough that, like, the sun and the salt water and Odelay would really keep me going, you know?
Amazing. Karina, before we let you go, tell us what you've got going on in your life. What are you working on? What's coming up, if anything?
You got it, Lucas. Wow. Well, first of all, this has been just a pleasure. Best interview I've ever done. And I've done a few. I really have. So thank you for letting me wax poetic about my favorites.
You're too kind.
It's too good. It's really too good. You know, it's been a strange time to be an artist. You know, there's not, I wish I had shows to plug. I don't, unfortunately, because they're illegal these days. But I've been working on tons of music. And I'm looking forward to releasing much, much more down the pipeline under my own name, Karina Reichman. You can check it out wherever you get your music. And, you know, God willing, bunch more studio stuff coming out. And hopefully touring will become legal again soon so that I can get back out there and spread the joy around the nation and beyond. So that's kind of the vibe.
Thanks so much, Karina. Such a pleasure. And I think you've just made everyone really hungry. So you've done your job well, and look forward to checking out some of the music that's coming up. Thanks for tuning into our conversation with Karina Reichman. If you dug today's episode, please subscribe to the pod, rate us 5 stars, and leave a review. You can also visit us online at beggarsbanquetpod.com and follow us at beggarsbanquetpod on social. My name is Lucas Samuels. Thanks for listening.